From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
American officer, as an Iraq vet against the war, I knew I had to hear the General Petraeus report myself. But instead of being let into the hearing, I was stopped and beaten at the door in the halls of Congress. And I found out later on, I got DWB. I got Democracy While Black.
The Reverend Lennox Yearwood of the Hip Hop Caucus. He's organizing an anti-war march in Washington this Saturday. Then Freedom Watch, a new group headed by President Bush's former spokesperson Ari Fleischer, begins airing pro-war TV commercials.
They attacked us, and they will again. They won't stop in Iraq. We are winning on the ground and making real progress. It's no time to quit. It's no time for politics.
We'll take a look at the Bush administration's public relations campaign to win support for the Iraq war. We'll examine the current political landscape, where the presidential hopefuls from both sides of the aisle stand right now. And immigrants' rights groups are organizing a boycott of Western Union. And in Milwaukee, thousands march against the Social Security no-match list. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The New York Times is reporting a long-negotiated deal over a new Iraqi oil law has apparently collapsed. The breakdown reportedly centers around a disagreement between cabinet members in Baghdad and Kurdish government officials in the north. Iraqi Kurds have already reached a series of deals with foreign oil companies in their oil-rich province. The apparent collapse comes amidst a new White House effort to convince lawmakers U.S. goals in Iraq are being achieved. Pushing through a new oil law has been high on the list. In other Iraq news, two of seven soldiers who co-authored an article last month criticizing the U.S. occupation have been killed. Yance Gray and Omar Mora died Monday in a car accident in Baghdad. In their piece for the New York Times, the soldiers said, quote, 4 years into our occupation, we have failed on every promise while we have substituted Ba'ath Party tyranny with the tyranny of Islamist militia and criminal violence. A Sudanese journalist jailed for more than 5 years at Guantanamo Bay is reportedly close to taking his own life. Sami Alhaj is 250 days into a hunger strike, protesting his imprisonment without charge or trial. Doctors who've examined him say it appears he's given up his fight to live. Alhaj was working as a cameraman for the Arabic television network Al Jazeera when he was detained at a Pakistani town on the border with Afghanistan in December 2001. He was transferred to U.S. custody and flown to Bagram Air Base. 6 months later, he was flown to Guantanamo. He has been imprisoned there without charge ever since. The Bush administration has announced it plans to make a new push for U.N. Security Council sanctions over Iran's nuclear activities. The White House says it'll gather the five permanent Security Council members for a meeting next week. Iran has refused U.S. demands to suspend uranium enrichment as a precondition to talks. In an interview with British television, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad said Iran has no need for a nuclear bomb.
We do not need a bomb. We are against bomb, actually. There are many reasons that we are against it. In our belief, we are against bombs.
In the Democratic Republic of Congo, at least 166 people have died in an outbreak of the deadly Ebola virus. This is World Health Organization spokesperson Gregory Hartle.
At WHO, we've received reports of 372 cases of illness and 166 deaths coming from Western Kasai Province in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Now, five of these cases have been confirmed as Ebola. And obviously, then, this is extremely important that it's Ebola, but there's also other things which we think are going on there.
Ebola has no known cure. The death rate can be as high as 90%. The World Conservation Union has added nearly 200 species to its list of those facing extinction. In its annual report, the group says more than 16,300 species are now in danger of dying out. This is World Conservation Union Species Deputy Christopher Vai.
The main threat is the destruction of the habitat. For example, the forests are being destroyed, coral reef destruction. The second menace is the invasive species, overexploitation, fishing. Fish are disappearing from our oceans because we overfish them. To this, you have to add climate change factors, which will have even more insidious consequences.
The report comes as a prominent British think tank is warning global warming could have effects akin to nuclear war. In a new study, the International Institute for Strategic Studies says global warming could be on pace to hit crop yields and water availability everywhere, causing great human suffering and leading to regional strife. In Japan, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has announced he's stepping down. Abe had suggested he would resign if he failed to win support for extending Japan's contingent in the U.S.-led force in Afghanistan. This is the Japanese opposition leader, Mizohu Fukushima.
From the beginning to the end, Mr. Abe has been indifferent to the general public's lives. And the way he announced his resignation showed just that. He didn't fully explain why he is resigning. I have to say, it's very irresponsible of him to leave his job halfway through like this.
A deported immigrant rights activist and her 8-year-old son led parallel rallies for immigrants' rights Wednesday in Washington and Tijuana. Elvira Arellano was deported to Mexico last month, following a year of refuge inside a Chicago church. On Wednesday, Arellano led dozens through Tijuana streets calling for an end to the U.S. government crackdown on undocumented immigrants.
The call that I made to be in Washington, D.C. on September 12th was important. I was deported, and this was where I was deported. Hundreds of families are separated here every day.
Meanwhile, in Washington, Arellano's son Saul led a chanting crowd of more than 150 people through the Capitol building. Saul Arellano joined with a group of other children to carry a banner reading, quote, "Born in the USA, don't take our moms and dads away." A union representing workers at 6 meatpacking plants has filed suit against immigration officials over raids that led to more than 1,000 arrests last year. The suit accuses the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement of roughly handling more than 12,000 workers of the meatpacking company Swift. The United Food and Commercial Workers International Union says workers not accused of any crime were handcuffed for hours and denied access to phones, legal counsel, bathrooms, and their families. The suit seeks financial damages and an end to the raids. And the Bush administration is facing major opposition to two potential nominees for key government posts. Senate Intelligence Committee members have asked the White House to withdraw its choice of John Rizzo for CIA General Counsel. Concerns have been raised over Rizzo's stance on the torture of prisoners. Rizzo told a Senate hearing in June he supported the infamous 2002 Justice Department memo that said torture would not occur unless a prisoner experiences pain serious enough to cause organ failure or death. This week, a coalition of human rights groups called for rejecting Rizzo's nomination. In a joint statement, Human Rights Watch, Physicians for Human Rights, and three other groups write, quote, "When Mr. Rizzo failed to object to legal arguments that defended torture, he failed to protect his clients, the president, his CIA colleagues, and the American people." Meanwhile, Democratic leaders are also warning President Bush not to nominate rumored frontrunner Ted Olson for attorney general. On Wednesday, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid vowed Olson would not pass confirmation hearings. Olson represented Bush in the legal battle over the 2000 presidential elections. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. President Bush is expected to announce tonight plans to reduce the number of U.S. troops in Iraq back down to 130,000 by next July. In a meeting with top Democratic leaders, the president said he was trying to find common ground on Iraq by planning to, quote, start doing some redeployment. But at the meeting, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi reportedly interjected by saying, quote, "No, you're not, Mr. President. You're just going back to the pre-surge level." President Bush will be outlining his plans at a nationally televised address to the nation at 9 p.m. His speech comes just 3 days after General David Petraeus and Ambassador Ryan Crocker came before Congress to recommend the continuation of the war for the indefinite future.
On Monday, at least 10 protesters were arrested during General David Petraeus's hearing. Most were arrested for disrupting the congressional hearing, but at least one activist was arrested for simply trying to watch the proceedings. Video posted on YouTube shows the Reverend Lennox Yearwood of the Hip Hop Caucus being tackled by six Capitol Police officers after he tried to enter the hearing. Was injured in the incident and was taken to the hospital. The Capitol Police charged him with felony assault of a police officer. Reverend Lennox Yearwood is the founder of the Hip Hop Caucus. He's among the organizers of this Saturday's anti-war march in Washington. He joins us from the studios in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy.
Tell us what happened.
Well, on September 10th, we went to hear the hearing, and I can tell you that it was for me, as a former Air Force officer, obviously someone who was the president of the Hip Hop Caucus, leading a march on Saturday, I knew how important it was to hear the general's report for myself. I knew that when officers lie, soldiers die. So I was going in essence, to make government more transparent. It was also critical for me as a person of color to be in the room to report back to my community. But instead, when I got there, I was waiting in line. I was standing there. I had to do a radio interview. I asked the officer, I said, can I step out of line for a second to do an interview? He said, no problem. I did my interview. I came back to the line. I got back in the line. I was waiting. And then all of a sudden, it was somewhat suspicious. Another officer came down, was passing out blue Post-it notes. And as he was coming in the line, he actually came to me and actually Colonel Ann Wright, who was standing with me. It was amazing. The two officers who were going in to hear General Petraeus, he actually told us both, you can't get in, and then walked past us. And so me and Colonel Ann Wright looked at each other and said, why can't we get in? He said, you can't get in. And so we went up forward, and we kept walking to the front of the line and said, why are we being denied? You just can't get in. And so somebody came and passed one of the blue Post-it notes to Colonel Wright and put it in her hand, and he showed it to him. He said, I didn't give you that. He said, I know. Why can't we get in? He said, well, okay, you can get in. And he said, well, what about Reverend Yearwood? He said, no, he can't get in. And that's when it started. I said, why are you singling me out? What is going on? It's important to know we have this huge rally at the White House and a march to the Capitol is coming Saturday. And I know my picture's on the flyer, but regardless, I asked, why are you singling me out? At that point in time, they began to be aggressive, and they got around me, and I said, you're going to be arrested. I said, what am I going to be arrested for? What have I done? I just want to go inside and hear the hearing for myself. At that point in time, one came behind me and said, you're going to be arrested. And then somebody grabbed me on my shoulder, and I kind of turned. And Amy, by the time I turned, I was on the ground. And I actually just felt myself going head first into the concrete.
Reverend Yearwood, to your knowledge, was anyone else who was on the line singled out and told they could not come in?
Well, there were three of us. One was Gail from Code Pink, Ann Wright, and myself were the three who were singled out. Obviously very prominent peace activists. And so we were the three. Gail, who was singled out, kind of moved to the side. And then myself and Ann Wright were right there at the front. And then somebody put a blue Post-it note in Ann's hand, and then he just let her in. So it wasn't about anything else. And then he just singled us out. He said, you're not getting in. It was amazing. It was just stopping the peace activists, like just stopping the peace activists from going in.
We're talking to Reverend Lennox Yearwood, president of the Hip Hop Caucus. How often do you go into congressional hearings? Do the police know your face?
Well, no, they definitely know my face. With the Hip Hop Caucus, it is our job to make government transparent, particularly for urban youth. What's so tragic about this is that we try to go into the halls of Congress so that young people can come and become familiar with the process. And obviously, they can not be afraid of the process. A lot of young people of color, a lot of young people, period, don't trust the system. And so not trusting the system, our job is to tell them to register to vote, to get them encouraged, to make it more transparent. And so obviously they know. Obviously they know that I'm also a peace activist. I'm also a member of Iraq Veterans Against the War. I'm obviously, I'm totally against this war. I think it is an atrocity. They know that. So I'm a face that they recognize. Not somebody, they know I'm also a minister, a man of God. And so they know who I, they knew who I was standing in line. And so when they pulled me out, they actually didn't pull me out, they just stopped me from getting in, and they wouldn't tell me why. They just stopped me. What was worse, when they leaped on me and started to beat me in the halls of Congress. And I said, here I am, a former officer lying in the halls of Congress while there's another officer in the hearing lying to the Congress. And here I am just lying and being beaten. I couldn't understand. It was, and I have to tell you, Amy, I was literally, when I was lying there, I have to admit, I actually, as a person, have lost hope for a second. I was sitting there, why am I doing this? I'm just here to try to make the injustice visible. I'm not hurting anybody. I'm not hitting anybody. I'm just here. I was in line. I just want to go in, and instead I'm being beaten in the halls of Congress, sitting here being leaped on by police officers and being beaten all for this reason.
They charged you with assaulting a police officer?
The amazing thing is that then after, obviously, I tore ligaments in my ankle, and then they took me to the hospital, and then they took me to jail, and they charged me originally with felony assault on an officer, and then the court, and they tried to ban me from the Capitol. And obviously that was thrown out, the banning of me from the Capitol, which is wonderful for our march, because we're marching to the Capitol on Saturday. And they kept the misdemeanor. So I'll be going to court against that. But it was amazing. I must say this, though. When I heard the chant, my mother in the movement, Cindy Sheehan and Didi, who was there, when I was down on the ground, I literally was just like, this is ridiculous. But I heard them say, arrest Bush, not Rev. I could tell you that I knew that the movement, we would not be denied. We will show up at every hearing. And our voices as the people will be heard.
Tell us, in terms of the upcoming march this Saturday, the response that you're hearing, especially in terms of the African-American, Latino, and the non-white communities, because many of the peace marches have still had very few or low participation level from those communities, even though in those communities the public sentiment seems to be more against the war than even in the general population.
Well, obviously. I mean, obviously, if you can beat on a reverend in the halls of Congress, how many of you want to come out to these marches? You're going to think the same thing's going to happen to you. If you can beat on ministers and fathers and priests and women, this is going to have a tremendous effect on communities of color. And so they recognize this. So obviously, their sentiment against this war is very high. They are against this war from the beginning, and it continues to be high. But regardless of that, what we have been seeing now, so many who have seen the video, they are saying that we are fired up and we're not going to take it anymore. And there have been so many from the communities of color, Black and Latino, who are saying that we will come out and we will march to the Capitol, because we recognize now, if we don't stop this madness 7 years into the 21st century, there's not going to be a 22nd century. Humanity is on the line. So people of color are uniting. And you're seeing the peace movement now, and it hasn't been seen. You're seeing Black and white and brown and yellow, male and female, straight and gay, coming together, because we understand that this is one of the most important. This is our lunch counter moment for the 21st century. And if we don't stand up now, we recognize that all could be lost.
Will you be on crutches as well on Saturday, Reverend Yearwood?
Unfortunately, I will be on crutches on Saturday. I'll be on crutches for quite some time, unfortunately, for what was done to me. I might have been beaten in the halls of Congress, but my spirit wasn't beaten. So I will be limping all the way to the Capitol on the 15th. And folks can find out about this at SEPT15. That's SEPT15, SEPT15.org. We need everyone. If they can beat on me, and the halls of Congress, they will come and beat on you next.
Reverend Lennox Yearwood, thanks very much for being with us, president of the Hip Hop Caucus, minister and community activist, one of the organizers of the anti-war march that will be taking place in Washington, D.C. on Saturday. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, back in a minute.
Most people think great God will come from the sky, take away everything and make everybody feel high. But if you know what life is worth, you would look for yours on earth. And now you see the light, to stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up, jump, jump. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up,
get up, stand up.
Don't give up the fight.
Life is your right.
Get up, stand up.
So we can't give up the fight.
Stand up for your rights.
Lord, Lord.
Get up, stand up.
Keep us traveling on.
Don't give up the fight.
Yeah.
We're sick and tired of your ism, schism, game, dine and go to heaven in the Jesus' name, Lord. We know and we understand, Almighty God is a living man. You can fool some people sometimes, but you can't fool all the people all the time. So now we see the light.
What you gonna
we gonna stand up for
yeah,
our rights.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You better get
up, stand up
in the morning.
Give it up,
stand up for your rights.
Stand up.
Get up, stand up, Bob Marley and the Wailers here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM, college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available in Spanish, in transcript and audio form for radio stations around the world to take. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan?
Well, President Bush's primetime address before the nation tonight culminates a carefully orchestrated public relations campaign to win support for the continuation of the war in Iraq. The campaign began in August when a group called Freedom's Watch, headed by President Bush's former spokesperson, Ari Fleischer, began airing pro-war television commercials. Then President Bush flew to Iraq for an unannounced visit where he met with Iraqi leaders at a U.S. military base in Anbar province. On the eve of September 11th, General David Petraeus and Ambassador David Crocker testified before Congress. Then they appeared exclusively on Fox News in what the network dubbed as a, quote, briefing for America.
To talk more about the Bush administration's public relations campaign, John Stauber joins us now in Madison, Wisconsin, founder of the Center for Media and Democracy and PR Watch. He's author of several books, including The Best War Ever, Lies, Damn Lies, and The Mess in Iraq. Welcome to Democracy Now!, John. Talk about the president's pro-war PR campaign.
Well, it was, of course, 5 years ago that President Bush launched his real pre-war, pro-war PR campaign on the anniversary of 9/11. And what we've seen over the last 2 months is another brilliant campaign using deception and non-existent links between Iraq and 9/11. And now something new, raising the specter of American defeat in Vietnam and the carnage that he says resulted from leaving Vietnam, to really hold his Republican supporters in the Congress behind his policy, a policy that's been quite transparent from day one. The president intends to keep U.S. troops in Iraq for as long as he's in office. What we've seen over the last month is the emergence of a new White House front group called Freedom's Watch, headed up, as you mentioned, by Ari Fleischer, the former White House PR flack, who was on duty in the White House in the selling of the war in 2002-2003. He jumped ship when things were starting to go badly in June of 2003, but he's back with a vengeance, lending his name to this Freedom's Watch. They're sort of the latest of a number of Republican front groups, along with Vets for Freedom, Move America Forward. These are organizations that are holding pro-war rallies. They're running TV advertisements. Freedom's Watch alone is going to spend $10 to $20 million over a month's time running pro-war ads that use wounded Iraq veterans and equate winning the war in Iraq with the terror attacks of 9/11.
Let's go to a clip. John, we're going to go to a clip of one of those ads right now.
Congress was right to vote to fight terrorism in Iraq and Afghanistan. I re-enlisted after 9/11 because I don't want my sons to see what I saw. I want them to be free and safe. I know what I lost. I also know that if we pull out now, everything I've given and sacrificed will mean nothing. They attacked us, and they will again. They won't stop in Iraq. We are winning on the ground and making real progress. It's no time to quit. It's no time for politics.
An excerpt of the ad that Ari Fleischer, the former Bush White House spokesperson, is working with. Juan?
John, this ad, once again, the repeated attempt to link the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon to Iraq and this generic, they attacked us. Could you comment on that?
Well, Juan, of course, anyone who is watching the broadcast saw the video and saw the image of jets hitting the Twin Towers. But they also saw the speaker's lack of lower legs. This is a severely wounded Iraq vet. And this ploy of linking Saddam Hussein and Iraq to 9/11 has worked as one of the three really big lies that originally sold this war. Of course, there's absolutely no truth to that, and no truth to the other two big lies, that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction or that Saddam was in league with Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. And yet, as recently as this Monday, the New York Times CBS poll showed that one of three Americans believe today that Saddam was personally behind the 9/11 attacks. 27% of Democrats, 40% of Republicans believe Saddam did 9/11. And just over a year ago, a Harris survey showed that half of all Americans believe that the weapons of mass destruction were found in Iraq. Huge falsehoods. And yet, this is what Americans are believing. And this, I think, is really the card that the president and the pro-war lobby plays so well. We have to stay in Iraq because these are the guys who did 9/11.
And how is it possible, in your estimation, given the enormous amount of news media that exists in this country, that these myths continue to prevail in people's minds, in so many people's minds?
Well, we've got to blame the mainstream news media. Of course, at the Center for Media and Democracy and on your program and in your reporting, we knew before the March 20th, 2003 attack on Iraq that there was no connection between Saddam and 9/11 or Saddam and al-Qaeda, and almost certainly there were no weapons of mass destruction. And yet this information was censored out of the mainstream media. The mainstream media really delivered the big lie by censoring out the opponents and critics of the war and repeating over and over these falsehoods. And then what happened was this. Most Americans get most of their news from television. And in April of 2003 and early May of 2003, Americans literally saw the weapons of mass destruction being discovered because these embedded reporters, whether we're talking Judith Miller at the New York Times, other major print media, the three networks, PBS, all wanted to be the first to break the story that the troops they were with discovered the weapons of mass destruction. So, as we point out in The Best War Ever, Americans actually saw the weapons discovered. They read about the discovery of the weapons. Of course, every one of those stories was 100% wrong, but Americans were promised by the president, the vice president, that they were there. The media delivered them, and the media has never corrected or fixed this big lie that's fixed in the minds of Americans.
John, can you talk about the Petraeus hearings?
The Petraeus hearings, really are a dog and pony show. Unfortunately, it's pretty easy to predict what's going to happen. Not much has changed in Congress or in the White House. It's really been a game of chicken with the Democrats gambling that by lighting a fire under select Republicans, they could break enough of them free that they would vote with Harry Reid and Pelosi beginning some sort of withdrawal from Iraq. But that clearly hasn't happened, and General Petraeus has been the perfect person for the Bush administration because that same New York Times CBS survey showed that overwhelmingly, 6 of 10 Americans look to Petraeus and other commanders to take charge of Iraq, and those are the people who they think are best equipped to end the war. Now, who is General Petraeus? He's an employee of the White House. The White House is really hiding behind not just Petraeus and the commanders, but these front groups they've created, like Vets for Freedom and like Freedom's Watch, that push forth pro-war, neoconservative Iraq vets.
As we talk about the Petraeus hearings, I wanted to play a clip from Comedy Central's Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Harper Magazine's Ken Silverstein credited Stewart with providing far and away the best analysis of what Petraeus said.
The general raises a key point. We keep hearing from President Bush how the surge is meeting its military objectives, but we need more time. Well, yesterday, the good general was whistling a different tune.
The military objectives of the surge are, in large measure, being met. It will take time.
My God. The president's been right the whole time. Even down to the details.
U.S. Marines and Special Operation Forces have been striking terrible blows against al-Qaeda.
Coalition and Iraqi forces have dealt significant blows to al-Qaeda.
Anbar province was al-Qaeda's base in Iraq and was written off by many as lost.
A year ago, the province was assessed as lost.
The consequences of withdrawal would be disastrous.
A premature drawdown of our forces would likely have devastating consequences.
Wow. I bet they're friends on MySpace.
That's right. Jon Stewart, Daily Show, Petraeus Bush, Petraeus Bush. Last comment, John Stauber. Even the language.
Yeah, I mean, this, again, is quite transparent. And the White House understands that by putting its message in the mouth of Petraeus, that's going to best resonate with the American public. That's its lobby campaign. And unfortunately, it appears to be working within Congress.
Well, John Stauber, I want to thank you very much for being with us. John Stauber, who heads up PRWatch.org and the Center for Media and Democracy, as we stay in Wisconsin, in Madison, at Wisconsin Public Broadcasting. Juan?
Yes, we turn now to the 2008 battle for the White House. Last night, all eight Democratic presidential hopefuls took part in what is being described as the first ever online only debate. The so-called presidential mashup was sponsored by Yahoo, the Huffington Post, and Slate magazine. PBS host Charlie Rose linked up via satellite individually with each candidate from his studio in New York. He questioned them each for 12 minutes on three main topics: the Iraq war, health care, and education. Many of the questions were submitted by readers online. The answers were not broadcast on television. Instead, their video responses will be broken into short video segments and posted on the three host websites later this morning.
The online forum is just the latest in the more than a dozen debates that have taken place so far, and the primaries are still over 4 months away. What does the presidential playing field look like right now? Where do candidates on both sides of the aisle stand, and what's the current political landscape? Well, John Nichols is the political writer for The Nation and the associate editor of Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin, where he joins us now. Welcome to Democracy Now! John, line them up.
Well, right now, I think it's safe to say that Hillary Clinton is still generally viewed as the leader in the race. But the reality is that nowhere in any of the early primary or caucus states do you see Hillary Clinton is polling above the low to mid-30s. And so you realize that more than two-thirds of Democrats are uncomfortable with her as their nominee or their potential nominee. The challenge, of course, is that John Edwards, Barack Obama, and to a lesser extent, Bill Richardson and Dennis Kucinich are dividing the votes of more liberal more economic populist voters in a way that essentially keeps Hillary out front. What is significant and what's developed in the last few days is something of a surge, and I hate to use the word, for John Edwards because of a number of labor endorsements. He's received the backing of the Carpenters Union, which is a very significant and very powerful force in the building trades across the country. He's also picked up the support of the steel workers and the mine workers. And, of course, the big ticket comes next week when the Service Employees International Union, with close to 2 million members spread across the country, will begin a process that could very quickly lead to an endorsement. At this point, the general feeling is that Edwards is in the lead in that process, but there's a real internal struggle there, perhaps one of the most intense internal struggles in any union, with California unionists, California SEIU folks being very strong for Edwards, Illinois SEIU folks being very strong for Obama, and New Yorkers being very strong for Hillary Clinton.
John, in terms of the other than the horse race of the polling, have any of the candidates, Democratic or Republican, been able to, on the major issue of the war, distinguish themselves dramatically from their other primary opponents?
There's some really significant stuff going on, Juan, and if we had a media that actually covered the war as an issue rather than playing around it, this would be much better known. The most significant action of the summer came from Bill Richardson, of all people. Now, Richardson presents himself as the foreign policy expert, the most experienced candidate, and practically he is a former cabinet member, former member of Congress, representative at the UN, diplomat in places all over the world. And what Richardson did during the summer was come out for essentially an immediate withdrawal, getting all U.S. troops, not just a substantial portion, but all U.S. troops out of Iraq in 6 months. This position actually did him a great deal of good in some of the early states. He moved into, if you will, a middle tier, and it put a real scare into both Edwards and Obama, both of whom have now moved to much stronger anti-war positions. Obama gave a speech yesterday in, of all places, Clinton, Iowa, in which he laid out a very strong, or 2 days ago, I should say, a very strong anti-war stance, very, very critical in saying the war cannot be won militarily, that the troops do need to leave. But still, I think the important thing to understand at this point
is— But did he actually say that the troops—my understanding is that he still favored maintaining some U.S. troops in Iraq?
Precisely right, Juan. precisely white, right? And this is where it gets really troubling. You have to distinguish between the good-sounding rhetoric and the specifics of the plan. At this point, really, there are only three candidates running who've come out for a specific and full withdrawal from Iraq. That's Richardson, that's the unexpected player in that regard, and Dennis Kucinich and Mike Gravel. Well, you're going to have some tests coming up very soon that are going to be important, however. I think that the coming votes on war funding are going to be a really significant challenge for some of these candidates, because you're going to see a lot of compromising, a lot of game playing with the White House. Chris Dodd has become something of a useful player in this regard. He has announced up front that he is going to vote against continued war funding. That's going to put pressure on Clinton and on Obama. Now, the last time we had a vote of this kind, Clinton and Obama played an ugly game. They refused to come out strongly until the eve of the vote, then quickly cast an appropriate vote against continuing war funding, but didn't make a big deal about it. Dodd is trying very hard to turn up the rhetoric on this. Richardson and Edwards will as well, and, of course, Kucinich. But the truth of the matter is that the only candidate who's anywhere near the first tier who's talking about a serious exit from Iraq is Bill Richardson.
Can you talk about the significance of Fred Thompson, Republican, entering the race?
Well, Fred Thompson is very close to a complete media creation. And, of course, that makes sense. He's a star of Law and Order, a guy who left politics to go into television, as opposed to Ronald Reagan leaving television to go into politics. But Thompson, at this point, is getting an immense amount of national media coverage. And as a result of that, in our celebrity culture, a lot of people turn up to see him as he campaigns. What's significant is that the polling in the early primary and caucus states does not suggest that there's all that much enthusiasm for Thompson. The interesting story really is that Mike Huckabee, the former governor of Arkansas, appears to be drawing more support from the sort of base conservatives and moving up rather significantly in the polls than Thompson. That doesn't mean that Thompson isn't going to have a significant rise, but he's going to need to have something more than just the press coverage that goes with his announcement. One of the big tests will come in the early debates. Thompson doesn't need to just do well in the debates. He genuinely has to triumph. He has to have a Ronald Reagan-style dominant performance, as Reagan did in the key early debate in New Hampshire in 1980, to solidify the interest in him. At this point, though, he remains more of a media creation than a reality on the ground.
John Nichols, very quickly, the significance of Larry Craig's troubles, of John Warner, Senator of Virginia, saying he's stepping down, and Chuck Hagel, the anti-war Republican from Nebraska, saying he won't run for president or for Senate again. Mm-hmm.
If you were a Republican strategist who had been delegated to worry about maintaining a good position in the Senate or perhaps even improving it, you would be pulling your hair out at this point and thinking seriously of quitting. The fact is that the Republicans are in a very, very bad position as regards the Senate. That's a good thing because, of course, the excuse up to this point for Democrats in the Senate has been, oh, our majority is very, very narrow. We have to rely on Joe Lieberman. There is a very real possibility that in 2008, if patterns hold, you could see Democrats picking up 3, 4, even 5 Senate seats in states such as Minnesota, Maine, and now, yes, Virginia is a possibility. I don't see Idaho swinging, but I do see some competitive races in the West like Colorado. And I will tell you this, the Larry Craig fight, especially Craig's refusal to leave, is an extremely big deal for the Republicans because, much like the Mark Foley scandal of 2006, it reminds the Republicans' fundamentalist Christian base that the party is rife with hypocrites and that they have been used. That sense did tremendous damage to the Republicans in 2006 with their base, and it could do very serious damage in 2008.
John Nichols, thanks very much for joining us, political writer for The Nation magazine and associate editor of Cap Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin. When we come back, we're going to look at a major march of thousands of people that took place in Milwaukee. What is the Social Security no-match list? And why are people organizing a boycott of Western Union? Stay with us.
happen for a week or a month or a year. With the blood and ink of the headline and the sound of the crowd in my ear.
Richie Havens, Lives in the Balance here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Immigration reform might have died in the Senate earlier this summer, but the movement for immigrant rights is very much alive. Although Democratic hopefuls at the first Spanish-language presidential debate broadcast Sunday focused on the importance of border security, immigrant rights, advocates aim to steer the debate in another direction. They're emphasizing the economic security of migrant workers. A network of over 150 immigrant organizations around the country have launched a boycott of money transfer giant Western Union. The organizations accuse Western Union of charging immigrants exorbitant fees and non-standard exchange rates when they try to send money home. The boycott organizers say that Western Union's annual profit of over $1 billion comes from the fees paid on remittances sent by migrant workers to their home countries. Yet Western Union, they say, reinvests only 41 cents for every $100 of profits back into those immigrant communities.
Kehan Irani is the New York, New Jersey coordinator for TIGRA, or the Transnational Institute for Grassroots Research and Action, the umbrella group coordinating the Western Union boycott, joining us now in New York. Welcome to Democracy Now! Explain what you're doing.
So the Transnational Institute for Grassroots Research and Action is working with, like you said, over 150 immigrants rights groups in America and overseas. We aim to get justice for immigrants and allow them to build the wealth that they have in their communities. You have over $236 billion going around overseas from folks who are working in different countries, going to their families to support them for basic needs. This is not, no one's buying a second car with this money, no one's buying a fur coat. This is for health care, this is for housing, this is for adequate education. And these basic needs are being charged exorbitant rates. They're people are really being taken advantage of. Their love, their commitment to their family is what's driving the profits of this company. And it's really sad to see Western Union completely withdrawing from any type of responsibility. And so we want to hold them accountable.
Now, my understanding is that Western Union has gotten into this position because in many places in the third world, where in a lot of towns don't have banks, but there will be three or four Western Union offices, so they are like the main transmitters of money.
Absolutely.
When you talk about exorbitant fees, what are you talking about?
So, for example, to send money home to someone, you can get charged between $15 and over $20. But the fees cost Western Union about $3 to $4. So the markup is huge over something that is not a luxury item. Sending money home is not a luxury item. Low-wage workers who need to support families in other countries who have been torn apart from families shouldn't be charged four and five times what it costs Western Union to send a remittance. It's completely ridiculous. All the money goes back into Western Union. The billions of dollars of profits, $1.3 billion in operating profits that they made, doesn't go back to the community. It goes into the pockets of the corporation.
We asked Western Union to respond to the boycott. I want to play an audio recording of this statement from Daniel Diaz, a Western Union spokesperson.
We're proud to provide fast, reliable, trusted customer service at competitive prices in a market with more choices than ever before. These choices have led to lower costs across our industry. We take pride in the role that Western Union plays in empowering communities everywhere by making it possible for immigrants to support their families and give back to those they love most. Finally, we're proud of the direct engagements we've made with communities and partnerships we've formed to take action and support programs that empower individuals to become more self-sufficient. At Western Union, we're committed to serving our consumers worldwide.
Well, I'd like to get your response to that comment, but also I understand that even some international organizations like the World Bank and others have questioned these Western Union rates and the impact it's having on transmittals.
In fact, the World Bank has said that if Western Union lowered their fees by a third, they would still be making plenty of money, that they would still have healthy competition and have a healthy profit margin over their competitors. The industry itself is inflated. The industry itself is being allowed to profit hugely because no one's been raising their voice. This is the money, this is the love, this is the commitment of millions of people who have been ripped apart from their families, who have to go work in other countries, and who work low-wage jobs. These are not rich people. I went to an ESL class yesterday to talk to some folks out in Queens, and when I asked them, I said, are you guys millionaires? How do you see immigrants? Do you think immigrants are rich? Immigrants have financial power? And they all said, no, we're not rich, we're poor. And I said, well, what about the $232 billion that you have? Because that's how much you've sent over the last year.
I was reading a piece by Francis Colpatura from Foreign Policy and Focus called Remittances for Money and Love. Interesting figure. Studies show if money transfer fees were cut in half, 33 million people could be lifted out of poverty in the developing world. That's for money transfer fees overall.
Right. That's the industry. And there you have it. It's completely ridiculous. It's really sad to see Western Union's comment about, you know, how they help immigrants build wealth and how they are giving back to the community and how they're very happy to empower the community, except when it comes down to it. 33 million people could be lifted out of poverty, and they're fighting over change. Western Union reinvests 41 cents for every $100 of profit back into the community. That's abysmal.
Well, we'd like to get into another issue. Meanwhile, immigration rights activists declared Wednesday a national day of action against new immigration measures announced by the Department of Homeland Security last month. One of the rules converts Social Security no-match letters into a tool of immigration enforcement. No-match letters are sent to employers when a worker's stated Social Security number does not match records in government databases. Until now, they were used to notify employees of the benefits they could lose as a result of the discrepancy. Under the new rule, employers are required to fire workers or face fines and criminal charges unless the discrepancy is remedied within 90 days. Last month, a San Francisco judge ordered a temporary stay on sending out new versions of the letters. A hearing is scheduled for October 1st, but activists warned that some employers are not waiting for the case to be resolved in court before taking action. On Wednesday, thousands took to the streets in cities across the country against this pending crackdown that threatens the jobs of 8 million undocumented workers. In Milwaukee, Wisconsin had the largest turnout, with an estimated 10,000 people observing a day of no work, no school, no purchases.
To find out more about the crackdown, we go back to Wisconsin Public Broadcasting. Christine Newman-Ortiz is joining us in Madison. She's the executive director of Voces de la Frontera, a low-wage and immigrant workers center in Milwaukee and Racine. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Talk about the protest yesterday and exactly what the Social Security no-match list is.
The protest was fantastic. It was organized within a short time frame, 2 weeks, and we really made it into a working event. We had several thousands of people who signed up to be part of volunteers of a rapid response teams. In the event that the courts do decide to go through with these letters, then we would have volunteers who would be able to help workers who are going to fight to keep their jobs if an employer decides that they're just going to have a knee-jerk reaction, fire workers right away, or try to use it to their advantage in terms of a labor organizing effort. And so it's really a strike fund. So we are really seeing preparing for both at a local level and at a national level in terms of escalating economic organizing against this initiative. There was a very nice description at the beginning. People have to understand that 8 million workers will be affected by these letters. An employer will be required to verify legal status and fire them if it cannot be resolved within 90 days. And the consequences of this will be mass layoffs, plant closings, increased racial discrimination, and I believe obviously a very fundamental shift to a cash economy and the rise of an informal sector in the United States. This will undermine our tax base, our Social Security base. By the government's own account, immigrant workers, undocumented immigrant workers, contribute $7 billion annually, and the suspense file since the 90s is at $189 billion.
Now, what is your concern about these no-match letters? If Social Security claims that an employee, that the Social Security number that they have is not a valid one, isn't that a question for concern?
Yes. Up till now, the Social Security No Match, Social Security Administration has been very clear that they don't serve an immigration enforcement role, and that is what the fundamental change would be. Up till now, an employer is required to check for typographical errors, inform the worker, because the whole intent of Social Security Administration system is to protect the worker, to make sure that their contribution is there in case they need it, in case of a death, a disability. But what this does now, it changes the rules and does essentially turn them into an immigration enforcement agency. It's not a role that SSA wants, but that is what the Bush administration ruling signifies. And the fact that the no match will affect legal workers as well, and that is the basis of the lawsuit. And if a legal worker cannot verify or cannot take care of the problem within that time frame, they will be affected as well.
But are there significant errors in the Social Security system? With the tracking of these numbers,
there is a lot of errors in the Social Security database. The majority of workers in that database, in the No Match, more than 70% are actually legal workers. So yes, there will be errors. The problem is that for undocumented workers, only through a legalization process can you actually fix the problem and then even tap into your contribution to the Social Security system. As we know, undocumented immigrants contribute to our public benefit system but receive nothing in kind. So we do need, ultimately, we do need a legalization program that is going to bring these workers out of this black market system. And then in the future, the other side of the coin is, of course, to deal with the free trade agreements, which have created the conditions of mass poverty that have brought, you know, forced workers to come here under an illegal status. And so it's really, that's the solution we need. And this strategy will only create increased economic and social crisis. And I do believe that the agenda behind it, in terms of the Bush administration, is to create that crisis to be able to push forward his agenda, which was a broad bracero-type program, guest worker program, which, sure, would legalize those workers, but create even greater conditions of exploitation. And that's been the record of certainly the bracero program, which was dismantled as part of the civil rights movement, and current guest worker programs and guest workers programs we've seen in other countries.
Christine Newman-Ortiz, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Executive Director of Voces de la Frontera, low-wage immigrant workers center in Milwaukee and Racine, and in New York, Kahan Irani, New Jersey and New York Regional Coordinator for TIGRE, the Transnational Institute for Grassroots Research and Action. And that does it for our program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, Hope to Conduce, Elizabeth Presser, Mateo Angeli Comet, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Carrie Mache. A very fond farewell to our dear Elizabeth Press, longtime TV producer here at Democracy Now!, for her dedication, her intelligence, her persistence. We wish you the very best as you cycle on in life and look forward to collaborating with you in the future. Also, special thanks to Becca Staley, Hugh Gran, and a very happy birthday to our archivist, Dave Rice. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!